When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, what's up, gang? It's Vince here, and boy, have we got a treat for you guys on the free feed today. Not that you deserve it. In fact, you should definitely stop listening right now and go sign up for the Patreon at patreon.com/frotcast. Are you still listening? God damn it. Oh well. Anyway, this week I'm talking to Steve-O, you know, from Jackass. You know Steve-O. Anyway, Steve-O has a book coming out. The book is called A Hard Kick in the Nuts, What I've Learned from a Lifetime of Terrible Decisions, and it's available everywhere books are sold. It's about Steve-O's sex addiction, his recovery from sex addiction, hi Sam, that's Sam in the background, and his relationships and what he's learned in recovery, all that stuff. Anyway, that's the context of the interview today, and I hope you enjoy it, even if you think you're too damn good to sign up for our Patreon. Do it, come on! Matt's baby just got born. Congrats, Matt! Anyway, sign up for the Patreon so she doesn't go hungry. Okay. I love you all. Enjoy. Hello?
Hello? Yeah, dude.
Hey, how's it going?
Can you hear me?
I sure can.
All right. Good deal.
So where are you this week?
At the moment, I'm in Chicago.
Right on. Are you in the middle of a stand-up tour right now?
It's really all just book promotion right now. That I'm doing some shows, but they're kind of rolled into book events.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you wrote about the sort of monotony of being a touring stand-up comic. Is book tour any different than that, or is it kind of the same hotels and planes kind of deal?
Yeah, the book tour is super reminiscent of the comedy club circuit. In that regard, yeah, I can't stand it. Plus, it's a lot more, it's super grueling. This last week has been super gnarly.
Is it just sort of like you go to a place and it doesn't feel like you've been there because you've only seen like a airport and a hotel and then like one venue?
Yeah, that's super fair to say, yeah. Plus, I mean... Getting right down to it, America's all pretty damn similar anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, with that said, Chicago's been kind of interesting. I was just in Des Moines, Iowa, super randomly, and I found that actually pretty interesting.
Do you find, like, the places you're going on a book tour are different at all than as a comedy tour?
I mean, it's the usual suspects, like... I started out in LA, flew to New York City, totally randomly went to Iowa. I did a Q&A deal at Iowa State University, which was rolled into a book deal. It was totally random. We took the Iowa State University gig over a trip to DC, but then we're back on the track with the usual suspects, Chicago. Then tomorrow I have an event in Detroit for Forbes, which mm-hmm. is pretty interesting. And then off to Austin, Texas.
So like when you're doing these book events, I don't know if there's like readings involved, but you know, you talk in the book about sort of needing to be the center of attention and get validation from the crowd. I imagine it's a lot different when you're reading and people are like sitting there quietly versus, you know, a comedy show where you're getting instant feedback on everything. Have you had to learn to deal with that in a different way?
I'm not particularly interested in sitting there and reading my book to anybody. Okay. I think that would be painful for all involved. Not that it's a bad book, but I just think that reading passages from books is a little bit, a little bit lame. What I have been doing is like Q&As. Mm-hmm. And I've actually been kind of enjoying that a lot.
What was the...
Even though I did a... There was a book signing at Barnes & Noble in New York City, which started out as a Q&A discussion and then the book signing. And they have since completely nixed the Q&A part because I've proven to be the, by far, the slowest author ever with a book signing. I just sit there and like talk to people and, you know, like take fucking forever. Like they were losing their minds over me. Like the store was supposed to have been closed at 9 p.m. and I was still going at 10:30.
Yeah.
They hated me.
What's the best question you've gotten during a Q&A? By which I mean, do my job for me right now.
Well, I love that, man. It was kind of fittingly the last question at the Q&A in New York. This girl was like, she said she was about to turn 18 and did I have any advice that could help her as an adult? And I told her that I think it's safe to say that advice that helps 17-year-olds or advice that helps adults also applies to 17-year-olds. And I told her that basically no matter what someone asks me for advice for, I'm always going to give the same advice, but you know, is whatever you want to do, just start doing it.
Mm-hmm.
With the caveat that make sure you're learning the correct way, because you don't want to go down the wrong path in the wrong direction and have to unlearn bad habits. But I think I had even more fun with that. I said, I'm going to answer your question by addressing the meaning of life. You know, I said it, I think people ponder what is the meaning of life as if it's some sort of a philosophical riddle or some unanswerable question. And I see it as painfully simple. The meaning of life is to pick one. Mm-hmm. You know, like and I said that I think most people's biggest problem is that they have not identified a goal which they're passionate about pursuing. You know, I think if you're gonna, a prerequisite for accomplishing anything is first identifying a goal. And, you know, that's kind of the biggest thing. And, then I talked about enthusiasm, which I think is really the engine that drives success. Of course, intelligence is helpful and talent is useful, but nothing fucking touches enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that when you break down the word enthusiasm to its roots in Greek or Latin, what you have is en theos, which means with God. So the implication being that when you're really passionate about something, when you're enthusiastic, you're doing God's work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it tickles me that shoving shit up my ass is God's work.
Yeah. You have a co-writer listed on the book. I always sort of wonder how that works. What was the writing process in working with the co-writer like? Does he interview you, or how does that happen?
Worth mentioning that it's the same writer who I did my first book with. The first book we did together was his first book, period. Both of our first books. I remember I picked David Peisner because he had written an article for me for Spin Magazine. And, you know, I had a fairly, a really good experience with him, like over the few days that we worked on that. And I told him that I'd like to work on a book with him, and that it was important to me that I make that decision before his article comes out, you know, like, which is a kind of a silly, dumb thing, but it worked out really well. And what the process looked like was a fairly insane amount of time recorded, you know, tape recorded interviews, mm-hmm. conversations. I believe for the first book, we tape recorded like 70 hours of conversations. And then the second book was less. I think it was more like 40 hours. Mm-hmm. And those tapes got transcribed by a stenographer, I think is the word. Once it was all transcribed, David Peisner effectively like poured through it and created drafts of chapters. Then as soon as he finishes a draft of a chapter, then he sends it to me and I revise it.
Yeah.
Send it back to him. And then he incorporates my changes, sends it back to me, and I revise it again. Now, as we approached the delivery date for the original manuscript, or perhaps shortly after delivering it, I asked David Peisner, because since we wrote the first book, which was published in 2011, David Peisner has done nothing but write books. Like he's become quite the prolific, you know, co-writer / ghostwriter. Mm-hmm. And it's been largely like biographies, memoirs.
Yeah.
Has been his thrust. And so I asked him when we finished this one in the 12 years since the first book, of all the books, has there been anybody who's been more psycho as far as like meticulous attention to detail and just tweaking over like every little thing? And he said, no, not even close.
Yeah.
not even close. I'm super, super proud of that. I really did fucking agonize over, you know, every detail. And I remember describing as the deadline loomed, that, you know, I felt that I was really at a breaking point with like, you know, which is kind of rich considering my job is to revise the fucking work he did, you know, yeah. But I took it seriously and it was a lot. And then every stage of the book process just presents a shit ton of work, dude. Like, I don't remember the first book being, I mean, I suppose I do. But fuck, this one was just a lot of work, man.
Yeah. You can do it for as long as you want to, too. It's just endlessly right. Tinkering. Yeah. So I got to ask this because I just got back from physical therapy myself and I wasn't even in Jackass. So like, how often do you have to do, you know, physical therapy, like pain management stuff for various and then like, how hard is that to do when you're traveling on the road for a tour?
I've been largely like super lucky, mm-hmm. with, you know, like I'm in like really pretty good shape overall. With that said, like this shoulder, it's just seems to be falling apart on me. I don't know what the fuck's going on with my right shoulder, and that's got nothing to do with any specific injury or incident. I think it's just normal 48-year-old shit. What I do have in my neck, I've got degenerative disc disease, which is just like, again, it's mostly just 40-year-old shit, but it's from throwing my body around a lot. And that's not really reached a point of being painful or debilitating. It's just kind of looming as an issue. And other than that, I mean, fuck, dude, like I can tell that I'm doing myself a major disservice by not having a super disciplined, like stretching regimen.
Mm-hmm.
That I think is going to replace my, lifetime regret, my number one regret from not diligently flossing. I think not stretching is going to overtake it.
Yeah. I mean, so when you're sober and you're dealing with a disc disease, like what is the line in terms of like pain management and what you allow yourself to do for painkillers and stuff?
Like I said, the degenerative disc disease in my neck has not presented as a painful situation or a debilitating situation. So as far as just like chronic pain that's daily and ongoing, like I'm really not in that situation. With that said, in my 14 years of sobriety, I've been through some fucking horrific shit, you know, like I basically shattered my ankle. I had a plate and 11 screws put into my ankle, and I've had all kinds of surgeries since I got sober. And, my rule is that when I'm in the hospital going into, of course I'm going to have anesthesia, you know, but, so whatever a doctor puts through an IV into my arm, that I have no control over it, that I got to deal with. Mm-hmm. But once I leave the hospital, I don't fill out a prescription for painkillers. I've not filled out a single prescription for painkillers since I got sober. Mm-hmm. Everything's been, Tylenol and Advil, and in the most horrific situations, Tylenol and Advil at the same time.
Yeah.
Amazing how effective both of those fucking things are.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Best case. Yeah. Definitely a lot of teeth gritting, I imagine.
Right. Dude, I remember my ankle being really gnarly. I remember, there was some like gum graft surgery, some bone graft surgery. There was third degree burns. Like I've definitely had a lot of crazy pain, and I think part of me just really gets a kick out of my belligerent refusal to take painkillers.
Yeah.
Like when it's really bad, I'm just like thinking, man, I'm gnarly. Like,
yeah.
I'm a gnarly dude.
Summertime and the living is thirsty. Again. Once again, I've done that joke. And once again, it's a great joke.
Very funny, Matt.
Thank you.
But you're right. It is summer. And during the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep my family and me hydrated and refreshed.
Here's the thing about Fiji water. It really is from the islands of Fiji.
You're a liar.
No, I swear to God, it actually is. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable, ancient, artesian aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. But I'm always wondering, Vince, how does Fiji water taste so good?
That's such a good question. And the answer is that as the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium bottled water brands, giving Fiji water its signature soft, smooth taste. You know, yesterday I happened to take my son to California's largest water park, and you know, it's hot out, the sun's beating down, you're carrying a toddler around, you get thirsty.
Sure do.
And you know what I did?
What?
I reached a meaty paw out for that natural artesian spring water that comes only from Fiji.
That's right. That's right. And listen, I enjoy Fiji water on a hot day. I enjoy Fiji water on a cold day. I enjoy Fiji water on a medium day. Just basically whenever I'm thirsty, I reach for a nice bottle of Fiji water.
I know your mouth gets dry when you're trying to do those royalty freestyles sometimes.
It does. It does. I have a very dry mouth. People have commented on that. And I like to wet it with the Fiji water. And here's the thing, Vince. Unlike some other premium bottled water, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring.
That's like the best kind of electrolytes. And this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water. And since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water.
Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office.
It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So you met, in the book, you met your fiance. I don't, is she still your fiance or are you guys like?
She is, yeah, she's with me right now.
Okay. So you guys met when you were supposed to do a stunt for a Pepsi commercial that, and that you
Correct.
Were, you weren't thrilled about it because you were like anti soda.
Yeah, I'm like, and it's crazy too, because like it, during like my lows with, my diet, like, you know, at times when I've been able to just sit down and just fucking murder a entire bag of fun size Butterfingers, like even through those times, I'm just like, nope, not soda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, man's got to have a code, right?
Like, right. not fucking soda. So yeah, between, the soda thing and, you know, the meat thing, you know, and like, I'm less, you know, strict about dairy, but philosophically, I'm very angry at dairy too. You know, anything to do with factory farming really upsets me. So,
yeah,
you know, promoting Papa John's pizza and Pepsi Cola.
Yeah.
Was, you know, and I love too that I say in my book that at that time, that's what it cost to buy my, I forget how we worded it, but to, you know, my, my morality, my ethical standards could be bought for $30,000.
I mean, I feel like that is probably true of a lot of people, but like, are there other things? So you ended up getting paid without them using the stunt, which seems like a perfect scenario. Are there any other like endorsements or things like that that have worked out that way where like you've gotten paid for not using something?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head that, that was, such a lucrative false alarm. No.
Are there other like endorsements or things like that where you felt like you were, you know, taking money?
Selling my soul?
Yeah. Like, are things that you regretted or felt weird about in that way?
I mean, for sure. For sure. I mean, again, I can't really think of anything, but what's more kind of at the forefront of my mind is the, you know, things that I've actually turned down. Like I've actually exercised some integrity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily need to throw anybody under the bus, but there was a so there was, you know, some garbage snack that was all about dairy that actually, like, it was a six-figure offer and I turned it down. I was pretty stoked about that.
Mm-hmm. So in the book you write about your relationship with Kat Von D and how that sort of ended partly because, you know, she wasn't super cool with you like talking about being a sex addict on stage, which
yeah, she was a private person. And mm-hmm. You know, and I'm categorically not.
Yeah,
so that whole dynamic really I think you know, that was the general basis for things not really being like promising for a long term.
Right. So like, what is it about your fiance that makes her cool with you sort of, you know, writing about it in a book and sort of being open with that stuff?
I think that the world is full of, maybe not full, but I think that there are a lot of people who have serious issues with acting out sexually in a destructive manner, who don't acknowledge that they have that issue, and they just continue to do it. You know, they cheat, you know, whatever. Like, I would prefer, and I believe I can say this about my fiance, that she would also prefer for me to acknowledge that I had an issue and really, really care about addressing that issue and conducting myself with integrity, accountability, and doing the right thing. You know, I'd rather call myself out for having done the wrong thing and, you know, be really careful to do the right thing moving forward than not call myself out and be a fucking scumbag, you know? So
sure. Like, do you do anything to where she maybe like doesn't have to, like, do you think that's part of it where it's one thing to like talk about it for you, but if there's a way to make it so she doesn't have to like hear it every time, do you do it like right. Some sort of separation there, or we like, hey, don't read these chapters or whatever?
It, you know what, like that's precisely what it is. You know, I think that my girl then, her name's Lux, never read my first book. She knew that it had, you know, all kinds of debaucherous shit in there that she didn't really want to know about. And this book, she's been fairly careful to avoid certain parts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like, with that said, she knows about all the chapters that she hasn't read. But yeah, I respect that. She doesn't want to read shit that is potentially upsetting to her. I respect that. And it's tough when you're setting about writing a book like this. You know, I think what was important both in the book and in my life in general is that addressing these subjects is done in a way that doesn't glorify it, you know, kind of, you know, like there's nothing about the way that I address that stuff that, you know, that glorifies it or celebrates it.
I mean, is that partly sort of something that you deal with in when you're doing like shares and recovery, where you're kind of, seems like some people when they're doing shares, like they ride the line between trying to acknowledge what was bad and not like just reliving their glory days kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, like in the whole recovery space, or I should say in the, you know, in the recovery community, we definitely try to avoid, war stories that are going to glorify our active addiction. I think I'm pretty good about that. I mean, you want to qualify, we call it sharing in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to qualify as an addict, but you don't want to overly revel in the what it was like part.
Yeah. Are we good on time, or do you need to?
You know what? I'm gonna. I'm pretty. Isaac, do I have another?
Yeah, it's 12:30. If you want to keep going, we can tell them you're running a little bit behind, but you do have something at 12:30.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind being a few minutes late, but I do have one at the half hour.
Okay, I'll go like one more maybe. Okay, so I was curious about what your dad's like. You kind of mentioned him. Sort of obliquely, tangentially, a little bit in the book. I know he was like sort of a corporate guy. What is he like?
Dad, I mean, I describe my dad as just like almost a human calculator. You know, he's just like, I don't want to say he's devoid of emotion, but he's just not, he's a pure logic machine and not particularly emotive. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the best way to put it. And, you know, with respect to the, you know, the nature of my art and how much of it kind of goes against his sensibilities, Dad's really, really good at compartmentalizing. Like he can, and he's really, really enthusiastic about the business, you know? Mm-hmm. Here's the thing I think that is pretty rad. And I don't even think it's in the book, but there's this saying, which I believe was attributed to Andrew Carnegie, who's, I might be wrong about that, but the saying is, the first third of your life is for making mistakes. The second third of your life is for making money. And the final third of your life is for giving that money away. And, you know, if we were to, you know, for the sake of round numbers, call a lifespan 100 years, you know, like I got sober when I was 33 and really, really did a great job of checking the mistakes box. And when I got sober in 2008 with the financial crisis, my life was in such shambles. I had every reason to believe that my earnings potential had either completely evaporated or was, you know, about to fall off a fucking cliff. And, you know, my savings were, you know, like more than half gone from the financial crisis. So I kind of, in early sobriety, I switched into a, you know, a mindset, because I didn't even think I was going to be fucking alive, you know, like I was pretty sure that I'd be dead. Now all of a sudden I might be alive for, you know, many more decades. Like it was scary. So I got kind of proactive since I got sober about trying to be more savvy in business. And I think that that's brought my dad and I super closer together. Mm-hmm. You know, like since I got sober, I've more and more exhibited my dad's traits, and our relationship is just so awesome as a result. Dad's on my payroll now. It's crazy.
Nice.
He handles all things insurance. Mm-hmm. And like way more than that. It's crazy.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, I mean, I could pepper you for a lot longer, but I don't want to make you late for your next thing. And I appreciate all the time you gave me.
Hey man, it's all good. I appreciate you as well. But and just to you know, kind of finish the thought about the, you know, the trimesters of life. Absolutely, I want to just be as fucking aggressive as possible at you know, business, so that like I can realize my vision, my, you know, Lux and I, our vision of employing hundreds of people to take care of thousands of animals, and to figure out a way to do that that affords me my own little like Graceland style fucking spot. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to have my own little museum because I'm a super attention whore egomaniac, and I want to, you know, I'm so jealous of fucking, I was just recently in Memphis and visited Graceland.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God. I was just like, this fucking guy, Elvis, has been dead longer than he was alive. Like still people are flocking to this fucking place. I'm just so jealous of that. You know,
that's your goal.
Well, I mean, I just thought like, I mean, like it was on our own, you know, on our own path, we arrived at wanting to get a big property and open up an animal sanctuary, you know? Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that for that to be a a successful, you know, like sustainable thing, that it should have its own revenue streams, you know, like, and so incorporating some kind of a Graceland like model, if that's going to help the place be self-sufficient, then fuck yeah, you know. It almost seems to just be synergistic with what a egomaniac attention whore I am, mm-hmm. and you know, our lofty goals of what we want to do. So yeah, man, that's super where my head's at, and you know, that's I'm in that second trimester of life, and I'm going for it.
Very cool. Well, again, thanks for talking to me, and really appreciate it.
Yeah, likewise, man. Thank you for your time, man. I really appreciate you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.